It is 12 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show, a mix of national news and local features, like what is coming up next. We're talking with Meadow Kaufeld. She is the Minnesota and Western Upper Peninsula Regional Biologist for the Ruffed Grouse Society and the American Woodcock Society. Meadow, glad to have you back in the studio.
Well, thanks for having me.
You are welcome. So let's talk about probably one of the biggest things on your radar right now, right, is the West Nile virus, how it's been, you think it's been impacting the grouse populations.
Well, there's potential for it. And they certainly have found it in Michigan. There were 5 or 6 birds that tested positive. A lot of those birds, well, all of them were submitted by hunters that had either found them dead or had found them alive and were able to catch them or harvest them because they were less than vigorous. And so, as you may recall, earlier last year in the spring, we had the Minnesota drumming surveys go through, and it was a 57% increase over the previous year. And usually the grouse are cyclical in their populations. It's a 10-year cycle. And so typically in the 4 to 5s are in the trough or the low point in the cycle, and the 8s and 9s are in the high point in the cycle for the years. And so we are kind of anticipating a peak in that population. The DNR survey, which is an index, not a census, went through and we had that huge increase. And so a lot of people were really optimistic about what we were looking towards here this fall. And well, it didn't translate into increased numbers of birds in the fall. In fact, we had less than last year. Some of our, well, for the National Grouse and Woodcock Hunt that's held here in Grand Rapids, 90-mile radius around Grand Rapids, we had a major decrease in success. In fact, the lowest harvest ever, 0.5 birds per hunter, which is really, really low, and especially compared to long-term trends. And I guess more telling was that recruitment was half as much as the average. And recruitment, again, is the number of young per adult hen entering the adult population the following fall. So those who survive through kind of that brood rearing stage and are potentially adding to the reproductive population the following spring. And, you know, there's a lot of questions. Obviously, it wasn't over any hunter's head that was out looking for birds. Obviously, there was far fewer birds out in the woods than they had previously experienced. And then just the fact that, you know, those birds, lower population numbers were just, it was a surprise. And certainly with that recruitment rate lower, we, you know, people are starting to ask questions and wonder. And in Michigan, they had kind of ahead of the curve, had some testing done on their birds and found it present there. Now, for those of you that aren't familiar with West Nile virus, which we should be, came to the United States somewhere in, I think it was in Queens, New York in 1999. Was kind of the first time that people were infected, and the prevalence increased on the landscape. It was kind of an unexpected thing, a new disease. And primarily corvids, so crows and jays and those types of birds, ravens, are affected by it. So those birds started showing up dead, and then there were human cases that showed up. And people, typically men over 65, are more susceptible to it. And again, it's an arbovirus. It's transmitted by mosquitoes, typically a bird-mosquito-bird cycle, and in particular the Culex mosquitoes are the ones who are more typically spreading this disease or transmitting it. And birds, unfortunately, are the host, so that they're kind of the reservoir host as well as the transmitting host. The mosquitoes can move it between bird to bird, and mammals.
What is Culex, is that what you said?
Culex.
Yeah. Is that a normal
genus
mosquito we see?
You know, I am not an entomologist.
Okay.
And I was thinking about that this morning.
Give
like
you a
I have
question. Huh?
I have no clue. When they're biting me, I'm like, that's a big one. That's a little one. This one has white legs. That has a brown spot. You know, maybe there should be a field guide to mosquitoes that I'm familiarizing myself with. But I'm not an entomologist. I'm not a wildlife vet. I'm just a wildlife biologist. So that should be, I guess, the precursor there is that I am not an expert, but I do understand the basics. And so just a heads up on that.
So you said in the spring, the numbers looked like they were going to be up about 57%. So what does that mean, that birds were born and then they died from a disease, or they, what?
So the drumming surveys are an index. So again, that they kind of, the most detectable period of time for grouse because grouse are typically cryptic. They're hard to detect. They're secretive. They don't hang out in groups. They're really drab colored, is the drumming survey. So the males are on their drumming structures drumming. And so you can run a transect in the same area every year and get an idea of whether or not the population is increasing or decreasing with multiple years of data. It's not a standalone pinpoint that can do really well because there's a lot of variation that goes into those surveys, weather, individuals, ability, things along those lines.
It's usually pretty, I mean, is it usually fairly accurate to go off of those?
Long-term trends.
Yeah.
So indexes at long-term trends. And so, again, we expected that the population would be increasing based off of, you know, our previous experience mm-hmm. with cycles and then also that number. The thing to note, though, is that the previous fall, you know, birds surviving the summer 2016 would have been adding to spring 2017. The previous fall, we didn't really see a huge increase. There weren't 57% more birds in the woods based off of our grouse and woodcock hunt data, as well as, you know, personal observation from hunters. And so that right there was kind of, well, you know, it's an awfully optimistic number. We're really excited. I'll take it. That sounds good. You know, I really hope that works out. But typically, that drumming survey is an index for the amount of adult birds going into the reproductive period in spring and hopefully translates into successes in chick survival, depending on weather conditions and then the catastrophic conditions of things like West Nile or other diseases, maybe even huge weather events that may be unexpected events in basically the phenology or the life cycle of these birds that would decrease the population without us maybe even knowing until it's much later or it has mm-hmm. passed.
So this is a trend, this West Nile, you were saying it's more widespread than in Minnesota.
Yeah, in the lower 48, it occurs in all states. And since 99, it's, you know, spread. And birds are highly mobile. They fly. And so, you know, there's reservoirs and the Culex mosquitoes and the other mosquito species that are throughout the U.S., you know, that disease spread rather quickly. And early on, it affected mostly humans and horses and then, of course, birds. And now they've got it in reptiles, including alligators. And it's interesting that, you know, some of those monitoring efforts across the U.S., especially in the South, they use sentinel chickens. And so that's kind of something interesting is that they are even using a gallinaceous bird or chicken-like bird to detect West Nile across the landscape in certain areas where with high prevalence. And basically, you know, it's a disease. We can't really manage it. I mean, it's a vast area. You can't kill all mosquitoes, and that's not advisable. And that's basically how they manage that disease. And certainly you can't vaccinate wild animals. But the point of having sentinel chickens or, you know, testing dead birds that are found is to get an idea of prevalence in areas where people might need to take extra precautions to avoid being bit by mosquitoes.
So does that translate into what if you shoot a bird and you don't know that it, I mean, can you eat that bird?
No. So West Nile, I believe it's like 133 to 140 degrees will kill it.
Okay.
And so proper handling and cooking of the birds, if you cook the bird, you're not going to become infected by the bird. And, you know, most people don't use gloves when they clean birds. But if you're really concerned about it, you know, use gloves, especially if you're a male over 65. But, yeah, no, it's unlike some of the more scary diseases that it can be destroyed with heat and with a lot of other basic disinfectants, including UV light.
That is Meadow Kaufeld. She's a wildlife biologist joining us on the Thursday morning show. Meadow, did you see it personally when you were out grouse hunting, the less grouse out there, or how was it for you?
Yeah, I studied ruffed grouse habitat selection as my master's thesis, and I really have felt like I'm going crazy. Like, I cannot find birds, and I have good dogs and I've been looking in the right places and I've had flushes, but not nearly as much as I have in the past. And I really sometimes feel like I'm going insane because I'm like, I should be able to find these animals because I know a lot about them. And so, yeah, it's definitely one of those things where, I certainly, my personal experience is they're definitely down in at least the areas that I hunt. They're locally, you know, there are pockets of birds where, you know, certain people are able to find higher flush rates, but compared to historic experiences, most long-term grouse hunters, this is the worst year yet.
So would there ever be a hiatus for a year on hunting, or has that been discussed at all to try to help the population?
So the thought is that, you know, West Nile is on the landscape, and in areas where habitat is really good, birds that even if they do become sick have a higher chance of getting well and surviving because of the inherent protection from predation. That would be, you know, something that would provide them a chance to basically recover. There is some debate on reducing populations or season length, especially in the winter. Pennsylvania is one of the states that has been very proactive in researching West Nile and the impacts on their grouse populations, and they found that areas where the habitat is better, the grouse populations actually seem to respond a little better. But if the habitat is poor, I can't remember the particular regions of the state, those populations remain depressed. And so they actually canceled their after Christmas season, which is the day after Christmas to the end of January or late January, which was met with some pushback. I mean, a lot of people have come to really enjoy hunting that time of year, no leaves, and that's a relatively comfortable time of year to be out walking around with a dog. And yeah, they've canceled that season because of the thought is that those birds are, you know, even though grouse are well adapted to the winter, they're vulnerable and they have a lot of extra pressure, energetic costs, things along those lines at that time of year. And so when you're harvesting those birds at that time, you're reducing the population going into spring. And the long-term thought is that hunting typically is compensatory mortality. So the birds that are taken as through hunting are what birds that would likely have died anyways. And in that case, it may be that it's additive. And so they've removed that season. And so there are some states like Pennsylvania that are trying that. And then also the chance that, you know, we could reduce bag limits. But, you know, it's we can't foresee how the agency will react. And we don't have a crystal ball that'll tell us that next year populations will rebound, because West Nile, the intensity of it on the landscape and how it impacts populations varies from year to year based off of the mosquitoes' ability to reproduce and develop. So say if we have a long stretch of weather that doesn't get above 70 degrees, those mosquitoes, the developmental process is delayed, and so they don't come out, and there's not as many life cycles in fall or summer, and so you theoretically wouldn't have as much of a spread of West Nile.
What's the grouse season in Minnesota? When?
Man, you guys ask this every time. I want to say, well, it starts usually right around September 15th, the weekend closest to, and then goes into end of December, I want to say. But again, I'm so embarrassed because I was going to look at that last night. I usually don't hunt after deer season, especially when snow hits the ground, because of my personal preference not to pressure the birds in the wintertime when things are stressful enough and they are the adult population.
You can find that information on the DNR website, I'm sure.
Any of the regulations, and then, of course, online, a quick Google search will get you to the Minnesota DNR regulations, and that's really embarrassing for me not to know.
No, but
again,
no,
I just don't hunt late season.
Yeah. We have would you mind a couple of caller questions?
Sure.
And you can, okay, so they asked whether West Nile might have to do with climate change.
You know, there is concern for climate change. Obviously, if, you know, we had a warming trend and our seasons were, you know, our summers were warmer and we had longer stints of warm periods, certainly mosquitoes may theoretically be more successful, but they also need moisture. And, you know, that's a really complex question, but theoretically, one way or another, certainly climate change has an impact on, you know, how those population dynamics play out. And go ahead. Yeah.
And then can birds develop resistance?
Yes, they can. And so one of the things that's kind of encouraging is that they do find birds with antibodies. And there was a controlled experiment in from Pennsylvania. They had a bunch of cooperators go out and locate grouse nests they needed. Chicks that or grouse that were never exposed to West Nile, and the only place that they could find that was through eggs. And so they collected eggs, they went to Idaho, they reared them, and then they had infected some of them with West Nile, some were inoculated and infected, and they found that, you know, 80% of the birds that had come in contact that hadn't been vaccinated against it either died outright or would have died in the wild. And so there was a few birds that survived. And so that gave hope that, you know, birds will survive and have those antibodies. And then also in the wild, we have found that birds do have antibodies, suggesting that they had encountered West Nile and survived it. And so whether or not that's heritable, that's something up for debate. But it is worth noting that bird species where West Nile is endemic in Africa and areas like that, they don't are not susceptible, or there's no mortality rate associated with West Nile outbreaks like there is here in the U.S. Our birds are naive, you know, and so maybe with multiple generations with West Nile in the landscape, eventually they would develop a resistance. And so there is hope. Some populations remain depressed. So certain songbirds and things along those lines with low populations remain suppressed, whereas other populations have recovered since the introduction of West Nile. And so that does also encourage the thought that it might be some resistance.
So you said West Nile has shown up in crocodiles?
Alligators. Yeah. And I believe that's on alligator farms. And I was reading up on it a bit because it's, you know, obviously it's fascinating. And they thought that that might have been from alligators eating uncooked horse meat. Might have been kind of an alligator farm situation. And again, I want to say that the sentinel chicken issue is or used down in the Louisiana area, places where alligator farming might be more prevalent.
And did we know that alligators were fed horse meat? I don't know that I've ever heard that before.
That could be in South America or Mexico. I don't know. But yeah, obviously alligators need to eat. And,
right.
Yeah.
And they'll eat meat.
Wow. All the things we're learning. I have only one more big question for you, Meadow. Are you ready?
Okay. Yep.
What would be a good Christmas gift for a hunter?
Depends on the kind of hunter. I guess if they're a deer hunter, a lot of deer hunters don't have nice hand warmer muffs. And some do use them. Obviously, they're popular, but I think that any way to help them stay warm in the deer stand is a great thing. And then you can never go wrong with a nice pocket knife. Or there's one that I really love is the Havilon knife. And it has a razor blade that you replace instead of the blade itself. It folds up. It's really light. And you can use it for everything. But I would say that a nice knife, but most hunters have a lot of knives, but a nice muff or something to keep warm, something universal that, you know, that they can even give to somebody else if they had to.
Well, and what's the name of the knife again?
Havilon type knife. It's
okay.
There's several brands that make them. Havilon is one of the brands, and they are... Blaze orange Havilon's nice because then if you drop it or when you're cleaning an animal, you can find it again easily.
Right. And you probably, as a hunter, you wouldn't mind having an extra knife.
Never. So. Never. Yeah. And I mean, most people, it's even handy just to have in your vehicle or, you know, you can never have enough knives, right?
And gloves, it sounds like, especially if you're a man over a certain age.
Well, yeah.
You can always use a new pair of gloves, right?
Well, that's a, you can get a whole box of the plastic or nitrile type gloves.
Yeah.
Practical, usable, doesn't accumulate. Eventually it disappears because you use it up. I'm all about using up gifts because we accumulate far too much stuff.
That is for sure. It's Meadow Kaufeld, wildlife biologist for the Ruffed Grouse Society and the American Woodcock Society. If you have a question for her, send it our way. Email comments at kexe.org. Thanks for coming in, Meadow.
Thanks for having me.